Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Financial Services and E-Commerce Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, January 5th, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today, we're hosting an update on the latest goings-on at the CFPB and a little bit of a look to the year ahead. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Our experts for today are the Honorable Wayne A. Abernathy. He is Executive Vice President for Financial Institutions Policy and Regulatory Affairs at the American Bankers Association, and he is joined by Julius L. Jerry Lozier, who's of counsel at Winston & Strawn. We're going to begin with Mr. Abernathy. So with that, Wayne, please go right ahead.
Thank you very much, Dean, and Happy New Year and a welcome, good morning or good afternoon to all of our listeners, whether you're in the East Coast, Middle America, or in the West Coast. Glad to have you on our call. The opportunity for us here is to continue what has become a series of calls hosted by the Federalist Society's Financial Services and E-Commerce Practice Group, which has been following very closely the dealings of the new Consumer Bureau. I guess we can still call it new. It's only a couple of years in existence. I will point out that about 3 years ago, almost to the day, I was in another teleform for the Federalist Society talking about the brand new Consumer Bureau, and I made a couple of comments, and I just want to refresh those here as we review where we are today. And I pointed out that the test of any agency of a government whose founding document begins with the words, "We the people," must be whether the agency and its actions add value for those people. That includes adding more value than anything that the agency or its actions might supplant or push aside. And it'll be hard to imagine an agency of government more saddled with that burden than the new Bureau of Consumer Financial Protection, since the Obama administration emphasized that this was designed to represent the people in the multitude of different agencies that we have regulating the financial sector. The argument was there was nobody in the entire financial services regulatory regime that was looking out for the individual consumers themselves. The question really is, how will we know whether the Bureau stays focused on providing genuine value to the customers of financial services, and whether this will increase the chance, and what can happen to increase the chances of it succeeding. And that's one of the purposes of what we have been doing at the Financial Services Practice Group, has been looking at what the Bureau does, and each month taking a look at the recent activities that affect the Bureau and the things that it's been doing. And my colleague on our phone today, Jerry Lozier, has been putting together meticulously every month a list of all the various different issues going on. Normally runs in three dozen or more separate items. Today we'll be looking at developments that took place mostly through the month of November and into December. That was a quiet time for the Bureau. There are only about two dozen events that took place. We won't cover all of those in our discussion today, but we'll cover some of the highlights, and we'll certainly be open to address any other issues that have happened since then, as well as during that time that we didn't touch upon, or expand upon them, if you wish, during the Q&A. We will try to touch upon the issues briefly as sort of a survey to give you a feel for what's been going on, although there's one issue we want to delve in a little bit more than some of the others, and that's this whole issue of indirect auto lending, where the Bureau is convinced that very significant and illegal and unfair racial discrimination has been taking place in that market. And to lead us off with that, let me turn to Jerry Lozier. And Jerry, why don't you brief us on that subject, which again we'll spend a few more minutes on than some of the other topics, but we think it is very important in terms of the issue it presents, as well as how it demonstrates some of the ways in which the Bureau operates. Let me turn to Jerry.
Thank you, Wayne. And the reason we wanted to spend a little more time on this indirect auto lending racism issue is that it is starting to get general public media coverage, and that's evidenced by the fact that on December 13th, on the op-ed page of the Wall Street Journal, there appeared a piece by Holman Jenkins in his Business World column, and the title of his column was "Finding Racism Where It Isn't," And he ended his column with the following paragraph, and I apologize for the intemperate, somewhat inflammatory nature of this quote, but these are the words of Mr. Jenkins, not our words. He concluded, quote, that our government stoops to such charlatanism should leave you queasy. Prosecutorial discretion exists to avoid injustice, not cause it. One would like to think a sincere, if absurdly overzealous, sense of fairness is at work here. Unfortunately, the truth may be that our government has simply fallen into the hands of liars and chiselers who have identified a shakedown that the current legal and political culture will let them get away with, unquote. And so he's talking about the CFPB concern about indirect auto lending. And this is a very high priority at the CFPB. I believe its genesis goes back to a practice in the old residential mortgage lending area called yield spread premiums, in which it was widely believed that compensating mortgage lenders based on how high the interest rate they could negotiate had the effect of discriminating against minorities based on the premise that minorities may not be as skillful negotiators, as strong negotiators as non-minorities, and supposedly data would show that higher residential mortgage loan interest rates that were negotiated under this yield spread premium practice resulted in higher rates being paid by minorities. The CFPB, in March of 2013, issued, without any warning, public notice whatsoever, or any public comment, a so-called guidance to indirect auto lenders. Let me go back one step. Indirect auto lenders, when you go to an auto dealer to buy a new car or a used car, if you're going to finance it, normally the dealer will take your credit information, fill out an application, transmit it to one or more banks or non-bank auto lenders, one of which hopefully will approve the extension of credit to you. And then the auto dealer then negotiates the interest rate on the loan and prepares the paperwork and has you execute it and then transmits that to the auto lender. In order to compensate the dealer for all of that work, many auto lenders provide what they call a dealer reserve, which essentially translates into compensation keyed to the amount of interest rate that the dealer negotiates on the loan. The March 2013 guidance from the CFPB expressly stated that indirect auto lenders engaging in this practice, which is virtually all of them, may be engaged in unlawful discrimination in violation of the Equal Credit Opportunity Act. Now, when you think that a lender is dealing with numerous dealers, you realize that the pricing of these loans is very decentralized. And it is a given among compliance officers that where you have decentralized underwriting or pricing practices, you run the risk of inconsistency occurring because of the decentralization. And if you have inconsistency, there is a risk that that inconsistency could have a negative effect on minorities. And so many lenders, therefore, centralize their practice to avoid fair lending issues. So the CFPB, in this March 2013 guidance, essentially is saying to indirect auto lenders that if you have an auto dealer out there who is possibly discriminating intentionally or unintentionally against a minority based on the level of the interest rates, you have a fair lending problem. And what is more, the guidance from the CFPB suggested that if you're an auto lender and you're dealing with hundreds or thousands of automobile dealers, the CFPB is going to examine you on a portfolio-wide basis, and it better find consistency in dealing with minorities and non-minorities. The Holman-Jenkins piece hypothesizes an auto lender that deals with an inner-city used car dealer and a rural or suburban high-end pickup truck dealer and finances the paper for both, all of that paper is going to be considered, the interest rates better not reflect higher interest rates on the part of applicants from minorities. There are an enormous number of ironies in what I've just described. First of all, the Dodd-Frank Act explicitly exempts automobile dealers from the CFPB jurisdiction. So the CFPB responds, well, we're not talking about automobile dealers, we're talking about the lenders, and we have jurisdiction over them. Second of all, as Wayne is going to discuss in a minute, there's a real paucity of data on the racial composition of automobile loan applicants. In the residential mortgage area, there's data required to be collected by federal law, the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act, on an applicant's race, ethnicity, et cetera, that's all filed with federal regulators. Much of it becomes public record, and that data can be used as a rich trove to ascertain on a prima facie basis, perhaps, whether a residential mortgage lender is treating minorities the same as it's treating non-minorities. That data is not available in the auto loan area. On September 8th of last year, a bipartisan bill was introduced by Congressman Marlon Stutzman from Indiana and Ed Perlmutter from Colorado, H.R. 5403, to invalidate the March 2013 guidance and to require the CFPB to proceed, if it wishes to do so, by rulemaking, where it can get public comment on this issue. After that, the CFPB, not standing still, announced in December of 2013 the enforcement action against Ally Financial, Inc. and Ally Bank. This is the old GMAC Finance. A $98 million settlement, $80 million of which was to be paid to minority borrowers for this exact practice of this dealer markup of interest rates. In September of last year, the CFPB issued a report called the Supervisory Highlights Report. The focus was fair lending in the auto loan market. And it the bombshell in that report was entirely apart from the $80 million that it required Ally to pay to borrowers, it quite quietly, its examiners had required banks it had examined without any enforcement actions to pay $56 million of redress to 190,000 consumers who were allegedly discriminated against. The CFPB simultaneously issued a so-called white paper which explained its methodology on how it identified the race and ethnicity of auto loan borrowers. And the methodology, which Wayne will discuss in a minute, I think, is called Bayesian Improved Surname Geocoding. And what it essentially is, it takes a borrower's surname and the borrower's address and uses those as a proxy to estimate the race and ethnicity of a borrower. This obviously is a practice quite arguably pretty rough and not particularly reliable. Finally, the last thing I want to mention before mentioning two brief developments in this area is that obviously the fundamental approach here of the CFPB is fair lending. And fair lending is not without controversy itself as a legal theory. It's based on the Equal Credit Opportunity Act and the Fair Housing Act. Everyone agrees that those laws prohibit intentional discrimination in lending. However, many regulators, some courts have suggested that, oh gosh, these laws go beyond just intentional discrimination. They reach conduct that has a disparate effect or disparate impact on minorities. This is based on an analogy to the Equal Employment Opportunity Act and other employment laws, but each of those statutes uses the word effect or affect, whereas the Equal Credit Opportunity Act and the Fair Housing Act do not use those words. Thus, there has been litigation over this, and twice in the last 2 years, two Supreme Court terms, the U.S. Supreme Court has granted cert to cases that would address whether or not these laws contemplate actionable enforcement action when there's disparate impact or disparate effect on minorities without intent to discriminate. And twice, the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department has persuaded the parties to settle their cases and withdraw the appeals. Many commentators infer from that a belief on the part of the Civil Rights Division that they're going to lose this a case like that in the Supreme Court. While those cases were pending, the Department of Housing and Urban Development adopted a regulation codifying the disparate impact legal theory. However, last November, the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia invalidated that regulation, and there is now pending in front of the U.S. Supreme Court. The court has granted cert in a third case out of Texas called Texas Department of Housing and Community Affairs versus the Inclusive Project, Inc., and many commentators believe that the state of Texas is not going to be as willing to settle as the parties in the other cases were, which leads me quickly, finally, to the recent developments in this area, and that is on November 28th, Toyota Motor Credit Corp. In an SEC filing announced that it had received a letter from the CFPB and Department of Justice alleging discriminatory pricing of auto loans and threatening enforcement action. And 4 days later, American Honda Finance Corp. made a similar filing with the SEC saying it too expects to be the target of an enforcement action. Wayne, that's what I've got.
Well, that's great stuff. Thank you, Jerry. And I think you can, as you're listening to our discussion of this, you can get a feel for just how significant this particular action by the Bureau is. But also we would make the case it's demonstrative of a lot of the other things that the Bureau is doing. And as Jerry is pointing out, the way that the Bureau tries to identify whether there's any discrimination taking place is to manufacture data that somehow or another would point to whether or not discrimination is taking place. Because understand, in the auto lending area, lenders are not able, not only they don't practice taking the data, they're not allowed to take information with regard to the minority status of their potential borrowers. They're prohibited from doing that. However, there is one part of area of borrowing, and that's with regard to mortgage lending, where there's an act that specifically requires lenders to gather that data, and that's the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act. And in November, the American Financial Services Association did a study. They said, well, let's take this data that the Bureau collects under the Bayesian Improved Surname Geocoding, and let's take that methodology and apply it to data we know. That is, apply it to the folks that have been borrowing mortgages under the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act and see just how predictive it would be. And it was fascinating. The AFSA study discovered that when you take the Bureau's methodology for trying to identify minorities and apply it to a group of borrowers whose minority status is known, it found it was able to discover only 24% of the actual minority borrowers under the HMDA data. And not only did it only catch a quarter of the actual minorities that borrow, but that methodology also produced 22% false positives. So it's very clear that the methodology that the Bureau uses to identify who the ethnicity of the auto lending borrowers is extremely flawed. And with that, let me hand the mic back over to Jerry, who's now going to talk to us about an internal study by the Bureau of the Bureau's own workforce.
Thank you, Wayne. People who follow the CFPB regularly realize that there have been some morale problems there. There have been congressional hearings into allegations of racial discrimination against employees and that kind of thing. And following up on that, on November 21st, the Washington Times published a story about a survey the CFPB did in which it apparently asked employees 75 different questions, and the responses it received suggested, unfortunately, that employee morale may be actually worsening there. The complaints from the employees in response to these questions covered such things as their reviews by their supervisors, a feeling that they weren't being their achievements were not being recognized by their bosses, that the employees didn't have power to do things that they felt they needed to do, and that the prospects for advancement in the CFPB were not high enough, and a general dissatisfaction with actually the policies and the practices of the senior leaders of the organization. So, Wayne, that was pretty damning, but Wayne, you
pretty made, significant.
Yes,
pretty significant. And then to in a similar, our next point that we'd mentioned in a similar kind of vein, the Bureau's ombudsman, the Bureau has an ombudsman, Wendy Kamenschein. I've met with Wendy Kamenschein on a couple of occasions. I am convinced that she is doing her best to create a very credible ombudsman program at the Bureau. The ombudsman program, of course, is an opportunity to have someone who stands between the Bureau and either the people that the Bureau regulates or the people on whose behalf the Bureau regulates, and to try to smooth things through. And each year, the ombudsman issues an annual report. In mid-November, the ombudsman issued her third annual report on the Bureau and reflects some significant concerns that have been expressed and remain uncorrected at the Bureau. Among those are a lack of clarity as to the identity of who the points of contact are at the Bureau, how supervision and enforcement work together, and where do you go to obtain interpretations. The Bureau has a wide swath of responsibility for regulations. 17 specific regulatory authorities were passed on to the Bureau under the Dodd-Frank Act, and yet persisting, one of the problems is you don't know who to go to at the Bureau to get answers to your questions, to find out who's doing what, who the points of contact are. And the ombudsman reflected that those problems remain unresolved. Our next issue that would tee up, and I'll hand back to Jerry, has to do with Social Security.
Thank you, Wayne. One of the problems with consumer finance regulation is that it gets so complex that from time to time you have regulations that seem to conflict with one another and create dilemmas for lenders. And an example of that comes up in the area of Social Security disability income. The dilemma applies to residential mortgage lenders. On the one hand, they are required by the Equal Credit Opportunity Act and CFPB Regulation B not to discriminate against borrowers or applicants on the basis of receipt of public assistance. On the other hand, there is a regulation to which they're subject based on the Dodd-Frank Act, it's CFPB Regulation Z, which requires a residential mortgage lender to verify a residential mortgage loan applicant's ability to repay the loan the applicant has applied for. And there comes a clash between these two regulations in the area of Social Security disability income, because apparently the Social Security Administration declines to document how long disability income benefits may last. So when a lender goes to verify, as required by Reg Z, the ability of the consumer to repay and how long will the income be coming in, the Social Security Administration declines to document that. And so the temptation to the lender then would be to say, well, we don't have documentation that the borrower is able to repay, so we're going to decline the loan. However, the CFPB issued a warning on November 19th that it's illegal to discriminate against Social Security recipients, and that the a lender should just assume that unless the Social Security Administration advises the lender that the benefits will expire in 3 years or less, the lender should just assume that the benefits will continue indefinitely for the full term of a 30-year mortgage loan. So that's the development from the Social Security Administration front, Wayne.
Thank you very much, Jerry. And one further point that we'll now talk about before we go into looking ahead at the year 2015. One of the pieces of legislation that was proposed during the 113th Congress that came to a conclusion in December is H.R. 4662, the Bureau Advisory Opinion Act. That was one of many pieces of legislation that was introduced during the last Congress that would amend, affect, or otherwise involve the Consumer Bureau. This particular bill, the Bureau Advisory Opinion Act, would just require that the Bureau has to respond to specific inquiries about whether a prospective activity complies with consumer finance laws. Since the Bureau has very significant penalties that it can levy against anyone who violates the consumer laws, the idea was that you have a new idea, you think it might work, you want to be sure, so you ask the Bureau, does this comply with the law? Is there a problem here? And various financial services providers were having difficulty getting answers to that question, so this new proposal would say, well, you have to respond in a reasonable period of time to that request as to whether or not this proposed prospective activity would comply with the consumer financial laws. That's what the bill would do. The Congressional Budget Office, as appropriate, was required to issue a budgetary cost estimate of how much that legislation would affect the budget over a period of the next 10 years. The CBO estimated that legislation, if enacted, would cost $815 million over 10 years based on a very interesting assumption. And that's a pretty high amount of money, $850 million, even over 10 years. We're talking about $80 million approximately per year. That assumption was based upon the Bureau's estimate that the Bureau would receive 5,000 inquiries a year. And one would think that if the laws were clear and understandable, if the regulations were clear and understandable, and the Bureau's interpretations were clear and understandable, then why would they have 5,000 inquiries per year about whether or not a proposed new activity was or was not in violation of the law? Very interesting question that, of course, was not answered, but perhaps will be answered in the year going forward. Let me turn now to Jerry, who will talk about a very interesting conference that the Bureau is proposing for 2015.
Right. Wayne, I think of this conference as a example of your taxpayer dollars at work. On December 1st, the CFPB announced that it will hold its first research on consumer finance conference May 7th and 8th of 2015. They encourage submission of research papers on such subjects as consumer decision making, how various types of credit affect household well-being, consumer financial markets, underserved populations, and innovations in modeling or data. And the purpose of this conference, this is the governmental purpose at work here, is to connect researchers and policymakers. And the announcement listed a, quote, scientific committee, unquote, consisting of 15 academics, including Professor Robert Shiller of Yale University. So I thought that was just an interesting example of perhaps if you wanted to cut the federal budget, maybe we could save some money and not host the conference, but this is something the CFPB needs to do, apparently. So Wayne, maybe we should talk about 2015 and what we can look forward to.
Absolutely, and thank you very much, Jerry. And I would say if you're interested in participating in that conference, you have some input you'd like to share, by all means, please go to the website and write a good paper and try to help the Bureau understand reality. So certainly, if they're going forward, there's an opportunity to help weigh in and participate in that debate. We're looking forward now with the new Congress, the Congress with majorities of Republicans in both the House and the Senate. It's clear that Republicans, before the enactment of the Dodd-Frank Act, were not very fond of the creation of the new Consumer Bureau. They haven't warmed to the Bureau, seeing its activities since enactment of the Dodd-Frank Act. And so a number of amendment ideas that have been floating around will at least will certainly be part of the debate, and very likely some of these will find their way into legislative activity by the Congress. Let me just put a few of those out on the table without trying to handicap what the likelihood is of whether this or that provision might get adopted by House or Senate or both. These are some of the ideas that are floating around. One would be to convert the Bureau into an ordinary independent agency. That is, one that has a commission structure rather than this consumer czar that is currently the leader of the Bureau. And that would be a commission with, let's say, five members with a requirement that no more than three be from any one party. That's the way the FTC is set up, the SEC, the FDIC, and many other financial regulatory agencies. Another regulatory or another legislative proposal has been floating around is would affect the funding for the Bureau. Currently, the Bureau is funded directly from the Federal Reserve. And the way that works is the Bureau goes to the Federal Reserve and gives them a budget and says, please give us the money. The Federal Reserve has to give them the money. They can't even ask whether they want it in 10s or 20s. They just have to go ahead and just push the money over to the Bureau. The proposal would be to take the Bureau and make it subject to the normal congressional authorization and appropriations process, again, similar to the FTC. Other suggestions that are floating around is that the Bureau should be able to enforce no rules except those that have been duly adopted in accordance with the Administrative Procedures Act. There have been some concern that the Bureau does not hold to the Administrative Procedures Act as carefully as it ought to, and this kind of legislation would try to tie them more closely to the APA and its requirements, particularly not allowing them to enforce actions that occurred prior to a regulation. And Jerry pointed out to one of the examples of that in the case of Ally Bank. One other that I would mention, and then turn to Jerry if there are any others that he would like to bring up, but this would be with regard to the Bureau's abusive standard. The Dodd-Frank Act gave to the Bureau authority for enforcing UDAP, which prior to the enactment of the Dodd-Frank Act stood for Unfair Deceptive Acts and Practices, kind of a fuzzy sort of standard as to whether a particular financial activity is unfair or deceptive, but there is some case history that gives some parameters to the meaning of those words. Dodd-Frank added one more word to that and said, now we're going to authorize the Bureau to enforce against any actions that they believe are either unfair, deceptive, or abusive. So I guess that means that if you have something that is neither unfair nor deceptive, the Bureau could still determine that it's abusive and take regulatory and enforcement action against the financial institution that was providing that particular service. And so there's one of the legislative actions that could very well take place this next year is an effort to either eliminate that abusiveness standard or to give more meaning or provide limits to it. Jerry, are there any that you want to bring up that perhaps I haven't touched upon?
Just very briefly, Wayne, and I know you're very familiar with these issues. One is that the Director Cordray sits ex officio on the Financial Stability Oversight Council and the board of the FDIC, and I know that there may be legislative efforts to terminate that status. Whenever there's a huge fine imposed by the CFPB, it goes into a fund that the CFPB maintains for victims and for its own purposes, and another piece of legislation would possibly require that those settlements be paid into the U.S. Treasury. Also, there's been a lot of concern expressed over the years about the data collection activities of the CFPB, and there likely may be some legislation to restrict the ability of the CFPB to collect data without more formal processes around how it does that. And finally, there may be a legislation, I understand, that may subject it to, as many other regulatory agencies are subject, to the Office of Management and Budget process to clear reporting requirements and things like that.
On the data collection that you mentioned, Jerry, I would point out that not only is there some concern as to what the Bureau is asking in terms of data from financial services firms, but also their proclivity to want to make that information public that they gather. And it's not clear, in fact, it seems to be, I think a good case can be made that the Bureau lacks the authority to make a lot of this data that it gathers public. It's one thing, for example, for a bank regulator to want to gather important information dealing with the safety and soundness and other practices of a bank or other financial institution. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't authorize them to take that information and then put it out into the public space, particularly when it may affect the competitive position and the methods and means by which a financial institution operates for the benefit of its shareholders and its customers. So that's another area where Congress might clarify that, okay, you can collect some of these data, but publishing it out in the open space, that's something that requires far more care than the Bureau seems to be showing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I might add, too, and Jerry, I think we've talked about this before, that those are just the various types of laws and amendments that the new Congress may take up. Of course, they have, both the House and the Senate, very important oversight responsibilities with regard to hearings and other activities that they might engage in, and we expect that that will increase. The Senate side has really been rather quiet as to what the Bureau has been doing over the past 3 years, with very few hearings other than the required semiannual have the director come up and talk about what's going on hearing. We could see that the kind of activities that the House has had to try to get a little more details as to what the Bureau is up to and what its impact is and the basis for its actions, also to be taken up in various hearings and other inquiries on the part of the Senate.
Good.
And with that, I think what we would like to do is, we've talked on here now for about half an hour on laying out a number of issues. We'd be very interested in questions from the people who are listening. If you want more details on any of the issues that we've discussed, or if there are other issues that we haven't discussed that you'd like us to talk about or that you would like to bring up, we would very much be eager to entertain those. So let me turn the microphone over to Dean Reuter, who will tell you exactly how you can do that.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Let's open the floor to questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that, if you have a question, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, Wayne Abernathy or Jerry Lozier, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are open. While we wait for that first question, let me just give you a quick programming update on calls later this week. This is our schedule as it stands right now. On Thursday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, we'll have a telephone conference call on college admissions and affirmative action. That will feature litigators Ed Bloom and Will Consovoy. They'll be talking in particular about a couple of suits filed recently against Harvard University and University of North Carolina. That is Thursday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. On Friday, we'll be discussing the Common Core Education Standards, also at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. That's on Friday, with Jimmy Faircloth and John Sauer, both law firm partners. Today, of course, Wayne Abernathy, Jerry Lozier. If you have a question, our lines are still wide open at this point. We don't have a question yet. If you have a question, you can be the first caller with a question. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let me ask a question while we're waiting to see if the audience rings in. Wayne, at the outset, you mentioned that this most recent report covers some two dozen or so significant actions by the CFPB, and previous monthly reports range up to the three dozen level. Is that attributable to the holiday or the end of the year, or is that a level that there's a plateau now? What do you expect in terms of just the level of gross activity on a monthly basis going forward, or is that knowable even?
Well, I, of course, I would be happy to assume that one data point is a trend and that we're heading down. But I suspect it has to deal with the holidays. Many of the news reports that I've been hearing, and actually some of the actions that the Bureau has been initiating in the latter part of December, suggest a very active agenda for the Bureau in 2015. In fact, one that I'd like to point to, and Jerry, I think, have some good comments on this as well. The development that took place since Jerry's November, early December report was the Bureau decided now to sue Sprint, a telecommunications company, which I doubt when the Dodd-Frank Act was being passed, Sprint was thinking, Dodd-Frank Act, that means me. But apparently it does. You have anything you want to say about that, Jerry?
Well, the only thing I'd want to say is I sort of feel sorry for Sprint. And, you know, I think of their compliance department probably as drowning in FCC regulations and never even thought about preparing for compliance with CFPB regulations.
What is the? There must be some rationale elaborated by CFPB. Is Sprint in the habit of loaning money to customers or financing deals? What's the rationale?
Well, the theory is that these things that we call cell phones, and of course the phone part is the part almost never gets used in our cell phone. We use it for all sorts of other things. Has now become a means of telecommunications for transferring payments. And I believe the theory from the Bureau is that Sprint hasn't been careful enough at looking at the activities of the third parties that are using Sprint to receive payments or to ask for payments and transfer payments from customers. And therefore, Sprint is somehow liable for the nefarious activities of the third parties that are using Sprint to bill customers for things that may or may not be appropriate. Which I guess raises the question, what does that mean that the Bureau will get into how Apple Pay is used or how the Google Wallet is used?
That was my next question. I mean, are they going to be regulating all aspects of the Internet, eBay, anybody that that accepts or processes a payment online? It seems to me that would give them a way into regulating the Internet. Is that right? Or
I think at least in as much as it involves payments, that are related to retail financial services, potentially it could be. Now, this is an untested theory. And so far, as last I knew, Sprint had not yet entered into a consent agreement with regard to the charges. I think they're still looking at them and may challenge them. It would be interesting to see whether there really is a legal basis for the Bureau to do this. I don't know. How do you evaluate it, Jerry?
Well, Wayne, it to me, it's sort of analogous to the stretch that the CFPB has made over the last couple of years to go after banks because of the conduct of some of the customers of the banks, and that somehow we're responsible, we being banks, are responsible because our customers have done something wrong, and therefore it was improper for us to process the payment. It almost goes back to Operation Choke Point.
Yeah.
At some point, it almost becomes akin to regulating the roads that people drive on to get to their banks.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Sure, yeah. You use the road to get away from robbing the bank, and therefore the folks that were maintaining that road facilitated your ability to escape, and therefore you're somehow involved in the bank robbery.
Well, once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our experts are happy to take your questions. We've got one caller question pending at this point, then our lines are open. Let's go to that first caller of the year.
Please go ahead.
Hi, it's Bob Driscoll at McGlinchey Stafford in D.C.
Hey,
I was wondering if you're aware of any challenges to CFPB's conduct, under the theory that ECOA does not provide for disparate impact. I know that the insurers, I guess, were the ones that ended up bringing the challenge for the Fair Housing Act more recently in district court in D.C. Have any of the folks subject to this litigated on that basis, or is it something they're just raising privately with the CFPB and I'm sure being ignored?
Well, I think that's yours, Jerry. Any thoughts
okay.
on that?
Yeah, I do. And I don't want to sound intemperate or inflammatory like Mr. Jenkins did, but the gist of his op-ed piece on December 13th, calling this CFPB indirect auto lending effort a shakedown, is that everyone the CFPB goes after in this area is subject to CFPB jurisdiction and examination, and the article suggests, and I think there's some truth to it, you normally don't sue your regulator. You don't normally take on your regulator, so Bob, people pay the price, it maybe as a cost of doing business, $98 million in the case of Ally, rather than fight it. I do think if everyone's correct that this Texas case pending in the Supreme Court knocks out this disparate impact theory, I'm sure the CFPB is going to have to accept that and back off. But I have a hard time picturing clients being willing to, banks and the people who are often the targets of these cases.
Yeah, Jerry, I noticed very few times when the Bureau has actually gone to court all by itself. It almost always operates under some sort of agreement, and often an agreement enforced or together with a bank regulator, whether it's with the Federal Reserve or with the OCC or the FDIC.
Interesting. Wayne, I would say that I think, from what I've observed, generally the people who fight the CFPB are the people who are sort of non-regulated firms, you know, collection agencies that are have been doing questionable things. Those kind of people seem to be the ones who kind of try to defend themselves against overreach by the agency. But traditional regulated firms, it's hard for me to even think of anyone who's actually fought the CFPB.
Yeah, not yet that I've seen.
I wonder
other
if the
than one case. Go ahead, Bob.
No, this is Dean. I was just wondering if the FCC will fight the CFPB. Is there any hint of a turf war there when the CFPB is entering the regulatory fray with Sprint that the FCC might have something to say about it, or is that not arising yet?
I haven't seen anything like that. Have you, Jerry?
You know, I may be wrong. I've got to double check, but I want to say that the CFPB worked with the FCC on that case against Sprint, but I could be wrong on that.
I just don't recall the details of that yet or not. It would be odd for the Bureau to launch out without at least having some kind of touching base with the FCC.
All right. Once again, Wayne Abernathy and Jerry Lozier taking your questions. We've got another caller question. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take our next question now.
Go ahead.
Caller, you might have your telephone on mute.
Sorry, this is Tony Cotto with the State Insurance Commissioners. I'd like to hear from you guys just sort of reading the tea leaves. I've noticed a lot of CFPB stories recently sort of about payday lenders and sort of other areas that they're looking at. Sort of, if you don't mind sort of giving us your best guess, what else do you see them getting into in the next few months or the next year?
You want to talk about payday lenders, Jerry?
I'm happy to do that. There's actually an article in the paper this morning. The payday loan regs are anticipated to come out the first quarter from CFPB proposed regulations, and they've been long awaited. Obviously, the story this morning was the effect that they're going to try to incent or encourage banks to make available short-term credit to compete with payday lenders. But there are a couple, maybe three other things coming down the pike that we can predict with pretty much certainty. Tony, one is the long-awaited arbitration study. Dodd-Frank requires CFPB to study so-called pre-dispute arbitration clauses and then to adopt a regulation based on the study. And about every 6-9 months, you see something out of the CFPB asking for information on this or that related to arbitration clauses. And so I think everyone anticipates that 2015 will be the year when the arbitration study is released. And as I say, it will trigger a regulation reflecting what's in the study. Secondly, people are estimating the debt collection regulations will be proposed in April. You may remember November 2013, CFPB issued a so-called ANPR, Advance Notice of Proposed Rulemaking, asking about 162 questions about the debt collection industry and how it functions, and implying that it was going to do all kinds of things, including possibly requiring national registration of debt collectors. So that I think people expect that the proposed regs to come out in April. And then, as I mentioned, it really looks like there will be more indirect auto lending enforcement actions coming down, certainly against Toyota and Honda.
And I would add to that, Jerry, the Bureau has been studying for, I think since its creation, the debit card overdraft protection policies of various
yes.
banks. That was one of the issues they wanted to take on immediately when the Bureau was created. As they got into the data, they discovered that the data wasn't quite telling the story that they wanted it to tell, and they have been engaged in far more study of the whole issue, but have announced that probably sometime in the summer you could see either a proposed reg or an ANPR related to bank debit overdraft.
Mm-hmm.
And then I guess I'd also mention, I think there was some talk of, it's not clear what the Bureau wants to do, but it wants to do something with prepaid cards,
mm-hmm.
prepaid debit cards.
Let me make another call for questions. Here, push the star button and the pound button if you have a question. I do have another question. One of you mentioned a victims fund collected by the CFPB into a CFPB account for the benefit of victims, ostensibly, and the possibility of a legislative retooling of that so the funds would go to Treasury. Are there constraints placed on the CFPB about the dispensation of those funds? Are they pretty rigorous constraints, or does some of that money find its way back into the CFPB coffers? How does that work, Jerry?
I believe the statute, to be fair to the CFPB, I think the statute does require the fund to be used to ameliorate the consequences of violations of consumer finance laws. I'd have to take a look at the statute to see if it may be broad enough that, it could be used almost for anything that the CFPB does.
Right. It depends on how creative they want to be. The first line is they're supposed to try to recompense victims in as much as they can find them. In many cases, it's very hard to identify who the victims may be in the case of a particular this or that violation, or very difficult to identify them and to provide some recompense. Then the statute says, well, then you can use these funds for financial education purposes. And as you and I can probably imagine, you can define financial education activities pretty broadly. And those funds can be used either for financial education purposes on the part of the Bureau or on the part of outside parties to which the Bureau wishes to provide some of that funding. Perhaps including my college-aged children.
Yes, it could. And some of the concerns is that by those who are very critical of the Bureau, that there's not much oversight on the use of those funds, and they potentially could be used to reward friends and allies of the Bureau.
Interesting. We do have another question from our audience, so let's take another question from our audience.
Is this regulatory agency likely to get into trying to regulate Bitcoin?
Interesting. My own thought is that I'm not sure, as broad as the authority of the Bureau is, and they are very creative on their authority, I have been having a little bit of trouble trying to figure out how they get to Bitcoin. I don't know, can you see a theory of how they could get to Bitcoin, Jerry?
No, nothing leaps out at me, but I do want to say that I thought I saw something a few months ago saying that they're monitoring Bitcoin or, these markets for that kind of artificial currency, but
they issued a warning, as I recall, or a guidance to consumers.
Basically it said
consumers beware, you might lose money.
I think that was it, and that implies, of course, that they felt they might have some theory under which they would have jurisdiction over at least the consumer aspects of that of the use of that currency.
And I would have have to say that the Sprint case makes me less sanguine that the authority isn't there when I saw how they're expanding to Sprint. Yeah, perhaps the argument could be made, if you're using Bitcoin to make financial services payments, that therefore it somehow or another becomes something, there's a connection there that the Bureau can use to try to go after it.
It sounds like they're almost trying to generate their own Wickard versus Filburn, that everything is financial, therefore we... And everything is done by consumers, ultimately, therefore we can regulate everything.
Mm-hmm. I wish I could ease your mind on that score, but I don't think I can.
Another question is, has any of the victims received any payment, or is that just sort of a fiction that they're going along to line their internal coffers?
I like Jerry's idea on how to do it. What's your idea on that, Jerry?
we were just talking about that before the call started, I mean, this is very obvious, but there really should be a GAO audit of these victim funds to see where the money is going and how much money really does end up in the hands of victims. My guess is not much, but I'm just very cynical. And of course, Wayne, when he talked about the Bayesian improved surname geocoding and the 22% of the people identified as minorities were not minorities, you can sort of surmise it. Those people could receive checks even though they're not minorities, and so clearly we're not victims of violations of Equal Credit Opportunity Act. But
Well, I think constitutionally anybody can state they're any race they want to state, and even change their race as they go through life. There are no penalties for it because it would constitute racial discrimination to penalize someone.
Yeah.
That, and there's no objective criteria for a race.
I think that's a very reasonable conclusion.
Let me make a final call for questions now. If you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We've got a couple minutes left here. Gentlemen, I don't see that final question, so let me give you each an opportunity to express a final thought, if you'd like to.
Well, Gerald, I'll give you the last word, if you don't mind me making just a couple of comments, and that would be that, one, that we will continue at the Federalist Society's Financial Services Practice Group to monitor the activities of the Bureau. We think it'll be a very busy and active year, and we'll be very happy to continue to have updates from time to time and share with you some of the thoughts that we have and some of the things that we see happening, and we certainly appreciate your interest in these efforts.
And Wayne, the only thing I would add is that I have a hunch that this is the gift that keeps on giving, and that we're going to have a reason to have these calls every month because the fun never ends.
Yeah.
Well, my thanks once again to Wayne Abernathy and Jerry Lozier. This is Dean Reuter signing off. I want to also thank the audience for dialing in today and for your thoughtful questions. A reminder that our next scheduled Teleforum conference call, which could be augmented between now and then, is set for Thursday, the January 8th at 1 p.m. when we talk about college admissions and affirmative action. But until that next call, we're adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.